really time to go.
And it's Penn Ultimate Day. And then Nancy's going to show. That's me. Nancy's going to 1-888-64-NANCY or also, alternatively, 1-888-0-NANCY. They're the same number, but that's the way it is. And I got a lot going on today. I want to jump right into it, actually, folks. Coming up in the show, we have next hour, actually, Sally Quinn, Washington Post reporter, with some, she's gossip political. And so we'll be talking a little bit about Elizabeth Edwards on Oprah today and why on earth. I have a theory, actually. I was thinking about it yesterday. Why on earth? I was on CNBC last night talking about Bernie Madoff's secretary came out on the Today Show talking about his past. So there's kind of a theme going on in the last couple of days. We'll be talking about that later in the program and much, much more. But I want to jump into the big news today, which is the banks. Okay? We're going to make you eat your vegetables. I know I'm so bad about this, but you got to know what's going on. The big news was that stress tests are to be released after the close of the markets today. But everyone knows what it is because they've been leaked for days. And the headline in the Wall Street Journal is that the banks need at least $65 billion in capital. Secretary Geithner said none of them are insolvent, made that blanket statement. However, a few of them need a lot of cash to look at, to cushion them through various scenarios here. So, you know, I've been thinking this over and working this out and wanted an expert to join me to ask some serious questions to about this. So Bill Ford is an economics professor at Middle Tennessee State University. He was a former head of the Atlanta Fed, Federal Reserve. And I understand, Mr. Ford, that you went to the University of Michigan, which is perhaps your greatest credential in my book. Did you?
That's right. I got two advanced degrees there, a master's and a PhD degree.
Well, go blue. Sure. I'm just a BBA from Bachelor's of Business at U of M, but, you know, whatever. It's enough to be able to read the Wall Street Journal. In any case, sir, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Nancy.
Okay, here's my question. What is your initial response to the word today about Bank of America and Citibank needing, and I think one more, that additional capital?
Well, they probably should raise some more capital. We should note, though, if you turn to the second page of the Wall Street Journal article that you're referring to, you'll see that Bank of America's stock is up 128%.
Well, so, yeah, I saw that.
There's, some difference between what the Fed stress testers are concluding and what people think about the Bank of America's future.
Now,
the Bank of America's protesting their findings, incidentally.
Right. In your view, sir, is there sudden change in fortunes over the last month due to the mark-to-market rule changes that were made?
Yeah, the banking industry is undergoing some stress that I'm not sure should be applied to them because in many cases, Nancy, there are projects, for instance, in your area where a developer has been developing a shopping center or a new home project or something, and the developer is continuing to pay the interest that they owe and the principal payments that they owe, and yet the examiners are coming in and saying, because it's taking you longer to finish this project than you originally estimated, we're going to tell the bank that they have to set up a loan loss reserve, even though they haven't lost a nickel on the project. Now, that kind of very stringent remarking ongoing projects which are being serviced properly by their owners who owe the money, I'm not sure that's advisable because it just puts the banks in the position of having to lend even less money, set aside more of their profits for potential losses that may never happen.
And right. Well, sorry, are you referring to, you're essentially saying that's what the revision of mark-to-market does?
Yeah, it's still, they're trying to make it a little more sensible by allowing some leeway in the way you do things, but it's still pretty tough, and I guess what the Fed is doing in a way makes some sense, but they've never before released publicly the results of examinations of any bank. It used to be against the law to do it, for anybody to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing this, you know, a lot of people can get scared about banks that they don't need to be scared about them. You know, like Wells Fargo, for instance, is a rock-solid bank. I used to work there 30 years ago, and Warren Buffett owns the biggest single chunk of it, and he thinks they're okay. So,
well, let me ask you this, sir, because I read Tim Geithner's op-ed in the New York Times today, how we tested the big banks. Because I know they're going to release these reports about they had a number of 150 bank examiners or something go in and look at the largest 19 banks, you know, open up their books. You know, let's just give them that there was complete transparency in what was delivered to those bank examiners. But here, and the idea of a stress test under certain, you know, best worst case scenarios. I want to know one question. What those scenarios are, and I don't know if they're going to come out, and I'm going to give you, I did not, are you from Michigan or no, originally?
No, okay. I live in Tennessee, and I'm from New York.
Okay, well, there's one question, I wrote this on a blog about this, folks, a new blog today called Cash for Clunkers. No, not the cars, the banks is the name of my blog. If you go to nancyskinnerlive.com, here's the question. I want to know if they figured in, when they looked at the various scenarios, economic scenarios in there, and whether the bank can withstand that, given that's what they looked at, is their capital cushion great enough to withstand various economic scenarios, did they factor the collapse of the auto industry into the worst-case scenario? Because if they did not, then all of these stress tests are useless. Because the jobs right now, the ripple effect, 1 in 10 jobs, that will materially impact the outcome of these tests and whether these banks can withstand it. And I'm guessing they didn't. What's your thought?
Well, no, they certainly did take account of the fact that we're not only having trouble with collecting single-family mortgage loans, we're having trouble with connecting commercial mortgage loans on shopping centers, casinos, and apartment houses and so on. And we're also having growing trouble collecting auto loans because more and more mm-hmm. people are falling behind on their auto loan payments, and that's certainly in their model of stress testing.
Yeah, but a total collapse is a different. I mean, looking at a loss of jobs, but as you know, sir, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs. And then the material, here is what one thing I talk about, Mr. Ford, that most people don't realize, being from here, is that, and I'm in the radio and business and work with televisions, I'm on TV a lot, is radio stations get as much as a third of their advertising from autos, as do newspapers and television. There's retail, you mentioned commercial real estate, and I saw on the Wall Street Journal as well today that they haven't really anticipated a complete breakdown of the commercial real estate market. You know, you got the dealership situation, which could tip that. I just think that scenario, it renders these stress tests, if they didn't completely anticipate them, useless.
You can be sure, Nancy, that they have, if anything, overestimated the likely losses coming from all those sources, because they are allowing, under some of their models for unemployment, for example, to go well over 10%, which hopefully won't happen. Now, with regard to your concern about a specific area, for instance, in Michigan, in the auto industry and supplier area, you notice there are none of the regional banks from your area on this list, although they're also examining them. The ones that are down closer to $1 billion and so on. And it may well be that your concern is going to be realized at the level of banks that are not in this Wall Street Journal article. We've already had over 30 bank failures in the first 3 months of the year, 4 months of the year, and we're likely to have well over 100 failures. And it wouldn't surprise me if they were more concentrated in particularly distressed areas like the ones you mentioned, Nancy.
Yeah, although Chrysler's largest lenders were Chase, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs. So, you know, I mean, there's some big banks behind some of these big auto companies. I will move on with you, Mr. Ford, because your time is valuable and these questions are important to me. So, okay, so let's assume that that they've done that. And now, if they need $65 billion in Bank of America, they're looking at a couple different options. One is, well, you can go raise private equity on your own, go out and raise money. How likely is that a scenario that they can do that?
Well, first of all, the Bank of America doesn't need 65. According to the report, it needs 34 billion.
Yeah, I'm totaling it up from the headline. Yeah.
Now, when you're talking about, remember, the Bank of America is a $1 trillion bank. It operates all over the world. It's taken over two huge companies, Merrill Lynch and Countrywide, both of which
not exactly great moves, though.
Well, you got to withhold judgment on that because. Ken Lewis, the leader of the bank, is saying that we've absorbed the losses that come with taking on those companies and they're starting to make money. Now, if he's lying about that, which I don't think he would dare do because he'd expose himself to all kinds of lawsuits as well as possible prosecution for lying, it could be that B of A will emerge from all this with Merrill Lynch and Countrywide being contributors to a bigger level of profits when the economy turns around. So we got to be a little careful about getting too hysterical about this stuff. And $34 billion is not a humongous amount for them to raise. As pointed out in the article on page 2 of the Wall Street Journal, they have numerous ways they can raise
it. So they can, and they can convert preferred to common, and that may involve the government owning more, having more control or ownership of that. I have one last very important question now.
Sure.
So what does this mean for those banks that want to repay their TARP funds? We've been talking a lot about this. A lot of them, in my view, want to eliminate the restrictions on them placed on compensation and other things, and so they want to pay their money back. How do these stress tests affect whether these other guarantees? There's lots of other forms of guarantees outside TARP funds that have been handed to them.
Well, first of all, they were forced, as you recall, by former Treasury Secretary Paulson to take the TARP funds, and some of them definitely didn't want it. A good example of that would be J.P. Morgan, which is a super powerful bank, is on the good bank list. It's adequately capitalized. And a guy named Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of that bank, is obviously one of the smartest bankers in the whole world, by the way. He took over Bear Stearns for like $2 a share and ended up paying $10 for a company that had been selling for $170 a few months.
So you think they're going to be able to pay their money back?
He's going to pay it back.
Get out.
He wants the feds out of his bank.
Yeah.
But what they're saying in answer to your question, Nancy, is we don't want you giving back our money, and we will let you do it, even though you didn't ask, you were forced to take it. We will let you do it until we're satisfied that you're okay with the
stress. Issue debt and common stock without our guarantees, what's wrong with that? You know,
yeah.
If we can take the training wheels off, And you can ride your bike, then fine. But until, if you need our guarantees to issue common stock and debt, then they aren't.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But remember that some of these banks, on that article you're referring to, the ones that are on the okay list, are in position to do it. And I think it's a good idea. If I were the CEO, and I've been CEO of two different banks, including one up in your area, and I'd be saying, hey, let me out of here. Here's your money back. Get out of my hair and let me run my bank like a private
Speaking of getting out of here, I got to get out of here and do a commercial break, sir. But
okay.
I very much appreciate Bill Ford, who was a former Fed member himself and a Wolverine as a professor of economics at Middle Tennessee State University. Thank you so much, Mr. Ford. Appreciate it. Okay, 1-888-64, Nancy, the number to the program. Got to run. Here we go. Money talk. You know me. I'm going to get this right. It's the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. A glaring omission, I think, in the stress test. That a lot of it, they didn't factor in a potential auto collapse bankruptcy when they said how much money the banks should need. Let's go to New York City. Don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to get Kitty in here. Hi, Kitty.
Hi. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Foggy. Did that man you were talking to have any idea what you were asking him?
I you know, it's sort of funny. He has a PhD in economics, MBA, PhD, and another degree from my grade school, and I don't think he did.
I don't think he had any comprehension what you were talking about when you were talking about the effect of the auto industry. He just thought you were talking about Michigan.
Yeah.
It doesn't just affect Michigan. It affects every place in this country.
I know. That's what he said. He said it might affect the regional banks in Michigan, but this is 1 in 10 jobs in America. And you know, I wish I had more time with them because we're looking at today there's a hopeful sign in the labor market. Not if these deals don't go through.
Yes, I saw that the unemployment rate has gone down.
Well,
it ain't going to go down if the Detroit goes totally out of business.
It's going to explode.
I know, and I don't know. Do our lawmakers really understand this? Are they all as clueless as this guy you were just talking to?
Kitty, I'm kind of afraid that that's the case. I hate to say it, but I'm thinking you're right. We'll be back on the other side. Take more calls. Amuse ourselves with Miss California, who, by the way, breaking news, may indeed lose her crown. We'll get to that in our silly section of the program. What else was I watching on the news today? Everyone's eagerly awaiting the Oprah interview with Elizabeth Edwards. President Obama, we'll talk about that. He talked about his fiscal responsibility, his budget reductions. Oh, yeah, that thing, fiscal responsibility. But, you know, the banks, this is the thing. I wrote a blog. I really highly advise you to. I'm going to start blogging, like, every day now that I'm not with you on radio, so you don't lose the Skinner thoughts, Skinnerisms. But this one, to me, it just hit me like a ton of bricks as I've been looking through these stress tests that are coming out. They're releasing them after the close of the market. So we'll be getting this news. I'm still in my my cave, but we'll be bringing news to you as they come along. But we kind of know what they are. They leaked it so it would have the market would then anticipate those effects in advance. They didn't want bombshells. Markets don't like uncertainty, so they were leaked, okay? But then I've been looking at them going, okay, and Tim Geithner wrote this op-ed today, how we tested the big banks. So even if they went in and looked at these 19 big banks, remember, folks, the money we have on the line right now is it's about 8 to 10 trillion. Some of that is in loan guarantees. Some of that is in direct equity. And then some of that, you know, are basically, you know, we own equity and then some are in loans. Okay. So, but we're not in control. We relied on bank examiners to go in and look at their books. And you know, every company keeps two sets of books, right? All right, if you don't know this, boy, the bean counter in me really is what came in handy. Every company keeps two sets of books. The one is their books for their public report, and it's their earnings report, and then they keep a completely separate books for their tax records. So they minimize their earnings via tax purposes, and they maximize their earnings for their financial statements that they release to the public for their shareholders. And they're allowed to do this. It's completely legal. They're just two different standards. I mean, this is how convoluted it is. Under FASB, Financial Accounting Standards Board, which is the group FASB that just changed. If you're not following this, and I just asked a former member of the Fed this question, the banks, their stocks were in the crapper too, like the auto companies. But they were lobbying hard to get this one mark-to-market rule change that said, okay, even if our assets are plummeting, we can assume that they're going to be profitable in the future and use that value. Kind of, sort of. I mean, they adjusted it enough so that Bank of America's share price went from, I forget where it was at its low, but low, like nothing, like penny stocks, to $128 a share. Do you get this? Okay, so right now GM's share price is $1.66. And they're giving them a hard time saying, well, if the existing shareholders will get 1% of shares, that means the company's worth $100 million. This company is worth $100 million. Okay, the Bank of America is not worth the what did he say, the trillions. Anyway, here's the point. Assuming that they gave us the right set of books to examine, then these stress tests, what they do is they put in models of, they look at their loan portfolio, and then they put like higher unemployment or lower or whatever default, which that's what I want to see. When I saw the op-ed today, how we tested the big banks, I want to see the actual methodology, if you will. I want the spreadsheet. It was a spreadsheet, I'm quite certain. And they just put, you know, like, the doomsday or the everything's okay or whatever. You know, they have different elements. And I don't know that we're going to get that. But I am certain of one thing. I'm almost certain. I have no way of knowing this. Obviously, this is what I wrote about my op-ed, that, you know, yesterday I said the House of Representatives passed this bill called the Cash for Clunkers. Okay? And what this will do, this is so important. It sounds silly, but it is so important because it will give vouchers to people who turn in their low-mileage cars for higher mileage vehicles. According to the Detroit Free Press, they're worth $3,500 if the mileage improvement is at least 4 miles per gallon, and $4,500 if it's 10 miles per gallon. Okay? Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot, but it will have a huge impact on the economy and fuel efficiency and climate change, just to even get that much better fuel economy. And it will move this inventory that is effectively keeping the banks in a straitjacket. I mean, the auto companies in a straitjacket. It's very, very important for people who want to buy a new car. They're going to get a heck of a deal on a new car. There's deals already out there. Now they get a voucher. I mean, it makes sense for everybody to get, because this is a demand recession, people. And like I just had this dispute with this banker, this PhD kitty in New York pointed it out. He did not get what I was saying. This is a demand-led recession. So you got to get demand for all things moving, which means raising wages, makes incentivizing the purchase of vehicles so that people start to buy all the inventories, all the junk that is being essentially just inventoried by retailers as they continue to lay off people. It's got to go in the opposite direction. So anyways, I said, look it, if you have with these stress tests, and you want these companies need $65 billion. I don't think they're going to be able to raise private capital. Because who's going to want to invest in Bank of America right now, given the uncertainties? So what that means is they're going to convert their preferred stock to common stock, which means that the government has more of an ownership stake. Because then you have voting shares in this company, correct? So we have more ownership of Bank of America and Citigroup. Now, if they did not, in this stress test, look at what a complete collapse of the auto industry would do to the numbers of these banks, if they didn't have that as a scenario, then the stress tests are worthless because so much of their business, their loan portfolio, their home portfolios, their commercial real estate portfolios, so much of it is upside down, and it's going to just ricochet through different sectors of the economy. And as Kitty pointed out, this guy thought, this is just a submission. No, gosh, there are dealerships all over the country. You think there are only dealerships? Haven't you ever seen a Chrysler dealership or a Ford dealership or anywhere and all the stores around those dealerships and all the parts and plants that come? And they supply not only those dealerships, the suppliers, but they supply your Nissan dealership and your Honda dealership, and the ad revenues go to all these papers. The Boston Globe is going under, and all. It's just insane how there is not a knowledge of this connectedness that must be factored in. And it goes in the opposite direction. Now, the whole theory has been, we got to get the banks going, get the credit flowing. You got to get, and I agree with this. I supported the president in this, right? Get the credit flowing. So the credit, that's why we had to prop the banks up. Get the credit flowing so that they could loan to small businesses. But, you know, so they could eventually, you know, keep the jobs. But if all of a sudden we face this huge wave of unemployment, right as we're recovering, and honestly, this is today's paper. It says private employers cut 491,000 jobs in April. And that is down from, that was in April, according to a report from Automatic Data Processing, compared with a steeper cut of 708,000 jobs in March. Okay. So good news, right? The pace of job loss is slowing. Friday is the big one, the big government payroll report. That will show a loss of 483,000 jobs. We're like happy about that. March was 663,000 jobs. So we're, you know, roughly 200,000 jobs less than last month. Now, mind you, in a normal economy, you need 100 to 125,000 jobs every month growing to sustain population growth. So when you're losing that many jobs, when you need to be growing 100 to 125,000 jobs just to keep up with the population, that's just normal. That's zero. That's zero growth. And they're happy and celebrating. And so the markets are, everybody's on crack right now. Banks are feeling good. We don't need that much money. We feel confident. We're going to pay back our money so we can get our bonuses. This is awesome. Job market loss is slowing. And there is an iceberg out there called auto industry, manufacturing, ripple on all these other companies. They'll go down with them, and those numbers go, it goes, that same domino effect goes in the same backward, same direction. More people laid off. They don't need loans. What do they need loans for? The big banks, all of a sudden those scenarios aren't factored in. And so then we're putting cash into clunker banks. Huh? How's that? That's what we're doing. If we haven't really factored this in, then when I say cash for clunkers, I mean we're putting in money into a sinkhole of banks, clunkers. So we'll see if that is revealed, the methodology for those bank tests and how the markets react to it. But we ain't out of it yet. Let's put it that way. GM had some tough news about their liquidity, too, today. So, I mean, they just got to change their attitude and quick about this. We just had to swallow hard, people. I don't care what your peeves of 20 years past are. Swallow hard. This is about everything. Really important stuff. 1-888-64-NANCY. I'll move along. There's lots of other things I want to cover today, too, and I'm running out of time. Chemicals of mama, I'm so hard to handle now. Okay, in the continuing saga of Hate Me, Love Me on the Nancy Skinner Show, we'll keep them emails coming. I love them. Nancy@NancySkinnerLive.com. It is great fun, and I do appreciate your emails. I had two people that wanted to weigh in on the Love Me, Hate Me scenario, and I wanted to get a shameless plug in for them, so it's my show. I'm going to do it. I have my – is this them? Hey, Creek. There you go. Put them there. Do we have them now? All right, you're bringing to the program two callers who say that they, I don't know if they're in the hate me or love me category, but we'll find out. Hi, Mom, Dad.
Hi.
Hi, Nancy. And we're definitely in the category of love you.
Oh, yeah.
And we love your program. We listen to it every day.
Now, listen, you have complained about a couple of things, though, but that doesn't put me in the I'm a Republican plant category.
Well, sometimes we think you go a little bit too far that way, but most of the time you're just fine.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dad. Okay, so this is my mom and dad. This is Chuck Skinner and Anna Skinner, and I wanted to bring them on the program, too, because they've enjoyed the show, and they followed my career for some time. And did you just hear me outwit that professor? Dad, did you hear that? I think I beat that professor from U of M up.
No, we didn't hear it.
You didn't have the show on. Okay. Well, listen, I caught you not listening. Okay, but here's the other reason I wanted to do this is that a lot of people ask me how I learned so much about business. And I remember my dad, when I was a kid, you used to have me read the newspaper. And the business, you know, I always had like the business section and whatnot. Maybe that's why I went to business school. But do you remember that, Dad? You made me read the newspaper to you.
Yeah, but also your mother made you go to libraries and had bookmobiles coming to the house, and you were reading Animal.
I could never keep enough books in the house for, you know, we have six children. Of course, you know, we have six children we have, and I could never keep enough books, especially for the girls. And, of course, one is a judge and the other is a talented Nancy Skinner.
Both voracious readers.
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, so that's how I learned a lot about business, and my dad was also an entrepreneur. So you've heard these commercials running on the show about my dad invented this device. He's had lots of inventions. He ran putt-putt golf courses, and he was a very successful businessman and football coach. But he also, you've heard these commercials, and I've been meaning to get him on to talk about this, because this is what the heart of America is. I mean, if you have an idea and you really pursue it, instead of just letting your idea go, pursue that idea. My mom slipped on an ice cube, and almost, you know, that could be bad. Mom was up in age, and so Dad went and figured out, well, you know, that darn ice cube thing, if you could have a lip, a really, like, an attractive thing so that those ice cubes don't fall over the floor, then you could put right in there and avoid that. So he went and got one designed and developed and manufactured, and got a patent on it, which took years and cost a lot of money, and now they're packaged, and he now sells them icecubecatcher.com on the internet for, what do you sell, $9.99, Dad? And you've got this business, and think of how many people are not going to...
They're $12.99. They are a little more expensive to make than I thought at first.
Oh, okay. Well, they're $12.99 then, so you can get them on the thing. But so this took you a long time to get all that thing, and now here you are, a small businessman in America, where they say 99% of all business really is. How's it going?
Well, it's going good. I sent one to New Mexico today. I've been sending them to Oregon, California, Pennsylvania, New York, probably because of your advertisements, because that's the only advertising I'm doing right now.
Well,
you know, mm-hmm. One thing, a lot of people have wooden floors, and they have water and ice on those wooden hardwood floors. And that's another reason that these are good.
Yeah, plus it's just sloppy, you know, when you have ice on the floor. And so, the cool thing is, my dad had them manufactured, and they're made right in Michigan. He's got a local manufacturing facility. And they come in black, and they come in
white and gray. I may start putting out silver ones for stainless steel.
Yeah, but stainless steel, that's black, because most of the lips, the plastic, Dan, I have stainless steel, and the black stuff goes beautifully. They're beautiful, like PVC things. So, you know, I really wanted to bring you on because you taught me a lot about, and he's had businesses, and a lot of people are hurting right now. They've had ideas, and instead of going to be 1 in 10 applicants for a job, you know, if you have an idea, this is the perfect time. We had the SBA, the head of the SBA on in funding. They have increased their funding, quadrupled their funding for small business, and just like this, take an idea. You know, my dad did it. You go get a patent. Sometimes you do or do not need a patent. He did in this case. But, you know, this is how it works, right? So people shouldn't stand in line at or look through help wanted ads.
Well, another thing, your mother liked, I put it on our house here in the northern area of Detroit, and We have a cottage up 200 miles north of here, and she insisted on having one up there because she missed it. And, you know, a lot of people, every place I've ever been, they've had ice cubes go on the floor out of those things. And what we have is an incomplete thing. A refrigerator is incomplete unless it's got an ice cube catcher on it.
So we designed it. My brothers and I have been part of this business. We designed the logo and whatnot. It's, if you go to icecubecatcher.com, you can see it and see the story. But it's a great story because it's just real people who, small business America, this is how, you know, people across this country are just going to have to work, build on their strengths, get some good ideas, and make things happen. And plus, my mom and dad wanted to say that they felt firmly in the "we love you" camp on my "hate me, love me" emails.
Well, we've enjoyed your career and everything about you all these years, and I hope this continues.
You're the excitement of our life. Yeah. By the way, they can use a credit card on that site and buy them, actually.
There you go, and PayPal. So there you go, Dad, the ultimate. Love you both. Thank you much. IceCubeCatcher.com. And two more votes firmly in the "We Love You, Nancy" column. My parents, Chuck and Anna Skinner, as we continue. Sally Quinn from the Washington Post up next. Day of prayer. Did you know that? Yeah. Come on. It's not marked on your calendar. National Day of Prayer. Today is a National Day of Prayer. And I think a lot of people are praying. We're praying here in Detroit. Please don't let the auto industry go bankrupt. Please, Lord. A lot of people are praying for a lot of things. the DNA test, this John Edwards gal pal is praying. It turns out her way, and lots of other people are praying about lots of things in politics these days. The Republicans are praying that they figure out how to make a comeback, find something. So joining me to talk about this is Sally Quinn. She's a Washington Post columnist, and she's the co-moderator of WashingtonPost.com's On Faith segment. And hi, Sally. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. So what would you say the big news is concerning? Every day we kind of have this this moment of, oh, is it appropriate for the to have a National Day of Prayer? Are we still fighting that fight?
Well, yes, we are. And, you know, I think that, you know, there's some very good arguments against a National Day of Prayer. I don't quite know what a National Day of Prayer is for. I know that the White House has sort of downplayed it by not having a major event. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, as Obama pointed out in his inaugural address, this is a country of believers and non-believers. I mean, it's a country of Christians and Muslims and Jews and Hindus and many other religions. But there are probably about 15% of the people in the country who are non-believers or would call themselves that, and maybe even more. And so, you know, I think that people don't even know what the word prayer means, because to so many different people, it means so many different things. I mean, you said, please don't let the car industry go under. I mean, I have atheist friends who say that when they get on an airplane and starts bumping and the ride gets bumpy, they say, please, God, don't let this plane crash. And then there are
people, depends on the urgency of the moment, right?
Right. And then there are people, I mean, there are people who are praying for themselves, like football teams at the half. Please,
yeah.
God, let us win. Which always seems, I always find that sort of mind-boggling when there are people being murdered and raped and starved to death in countries all over the world. And
you could make that extension, and that has been made when we say God bless America.
Right.
If we're in a war, then that's almost, it's a writ large version of that football analogy, right?
And right. Or, you know, I mean, it, you know, let us win the war, or mm-hmm. let us, you know, and is God putting, having to make a choice between, you know, the poor woman in Darfur whose baby is bayoneted, you know, taken out of her arms and thrown into the fire, and whether a football team is going to win or not.
Right.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
So the question is, what is prayer for? I mean, a lot of people pray. I don't believe in praying for something, some material thing, or even something for yourself. But I do believe that prayer is a personal thing, and there are many ways to look at prayer. I mean, you can look at a beautiful sky or a flower or something and say that is a prayer, you know?
Yeah. You'd almost want to have, like, I think, because prayer, that word, it has, it's, you know, it's been so defined for so long as a specific thing. But, I mean, a sense of let's all step back and realize that it's all going to end, you know, that we are all mortal, believe it or not.
Right.
Some people don't act like they're mortal.
Please, God, don't let me die. Right.
Well, we're all, you know what? It's going to happen to every single one of us, Sally.
Yeah.
And, you know, so let's move on to another question, because this sort of, I've been wondering this since I heard Elizabeth, that Edwards was going to do this interview on Oprah. And I was thinking, why on earth her cancer is considered terminal but treatable. I guess she's in that, you know, that caught between that middle ground, whatever that is medically. But she just certainly doesn't need money. They have lots of money. So people say book deal. I said, come on, she doesn't need that.
Mm-hmm.
She's so past that. The only thing I can think of, Sally, is that she's trying to redeem her husband's career, and even if she's not here, she's trying to somehow make, because there's some questions about the, you know, this woman wants a DNA test now and all this, that she can somehow redeem his career or restore his reputation in the public's mind, because certainly no one blames her for it, so she must be doing it for him.
I think it's so much more complicated. She apparently said to Oprah, when Oprah said, are you still in love with him, and she said, that's complicated. I think this whole thing is complicated. I can't understand why she felt that she had to write this book, because it can only serve to dredge up this whole story again, and it can't be anything but painful for her children.
Well, apparently she got the book deal before, for this book, Resilience, before, that she found out about the affair and felt that if she didn't journalistically include that in the book, that it would be.
Well, there's such a thing as giving back the advance, you know.
I just
don't understand it. The children have already been through so much, and they've been so exposed and so humiliated by this, and so is she. You know, she's a woman who's had a child die, and she's had cancer, and she's had all this trauma. Anybody who's lost a child, I give a pass, you know. And I have a feeling that she's really just floundering, that she doesn't know how to handle this, and that in some way this is some kind of therapy, that it's like going into a room and just screaming as loud as you can, except that she's doing it in public. It's a cry of anguish, and it just makes me so sad to see this, because I don't think that she needs to do this. As you say, she doesn't need the money.
Certainly.
So she's not going to redeem his career by reminding everybody of what a horrible thing he's done.
Well, you know what? Let me question you a little bit on that, because, you know, everyone says, oh, I saw the coverage, too, and I have the cut of her saying on Oprah what you said. But that that you in the storyline, and you know storylines better than and most, Sally Quinn, you have to have that moment of forgiveness, like the 60 Minutes Steve Croft interview with Hillary and Bill Clinton, that has to happen before there can be the wound starts to heal.
Yeah.
And so what my thought might be is that... But she's doing it for that reason, that she's trying to, I mean, she's somehow gotten past it personally and realizes she's got to get it out there and let people know she's okay and accepting it and move on before they or he and his career can move on.
Yeah, I think, but I don't think that she's okay with it, you know? I mean, she doesn't even know whether that child is his or not. And she doesn't, you know, she's still not sure whether she's in love with him. So it's, and she doesn't know what her health prognosis really is at this point, at least we don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I there are just so many things that I don't believe that she's okay is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I believe that she's just out there bleeding in front of the whole country, and it just makes me feel sad for her.
I know. If anybody can help her, it's Oprah.
Yeah. I mean, this is, as I say, this may be some form of therapy for her.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the way I would choose to deal with it, just because I would want to protect the children.
Right. Now, other people are saying, well, he has no career because of this high-profile affair. And I said, two words for you. Newt Gingrich out there today in front of the White House, you know, trying to position himself as the leader of the Republican Party. What, four wives and had affairs during the impeachment process, we found out. So the public does have a short memory.
Well, I don't. I mean, it's not like he's never going to have a career. I don't ever. I would, you know, I would really be surprised if he ever got elected president. but I don't think that this book is going to redeem him or, you know, somehow resurrect his career. I mean, this is totally for herself and for her own survival.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll see what.
You know, the other thing is, it just was so hard as to when she knew about this other woman to let him run. All she had to do was, I mean, because that it's always going to come out, always, and especially if he had won the Democratic nomination. I mean, imagine how horrible that would have been. You know, so I mean, not only was she allowing him to, you know, do damage to herself and her children, but also to the country. And, you know, she could easily have just said to him, you know what, Buster, you're not running.
Yeah.
And that would have been the end of it.
Well, this is an endless parade of women that stand behind their husbands at crying press conferences,
even
when their husband's saying, I'm gay.
Yeah, exactly.
Go figure. They're together as far as we know. We don't know what the state of that relationship is, but they're not. They're living together, right?
Yeah.
So we know that much. Sally Quinn is with me from the Washington Post. We're going through a couple of political headlines. Sally, I got to ask you about Bristol Palin and what this is about, and if this is a part of a rehabilitation campaign for Sarah Palin. I don't know who's trying to rehabilitate whom anymore. Sally Quinn is my guest from the Washington Post. She also moderates a forum, co-moderates on faith at thewashingtonpost.com. So we'll come back. More of your calls, 1-888-64-NANCY, a national day of prayer. So think about what's the one prayer you want answered. I'm going to address that later in the show. On the Nancy Skinner Show. Here we go. As we move along, and then Nancy's going to show 1-888-64-NANCY on National Day of Prayer. We've been talking about banking crises and auto crises and global meltdowns for so long. We thought we would reach into and talk about some really deep things like Sarah Palin, Bristol Palin, and other political headlines of the day. Elizabeth Edwards. Joining me is Sally Quinn. She is the columnist at the Washington Post, and she's also moderating a forum at WashingtonPost.com's On Faith. That's very interesting. Before we get to the Bristol Palin, as intriguing as that is, Sally, you don't get much closer to God than a Supreme Court nomination. I have a theory. I'm hearing bits and pieces of what various senators are saying about this and that and what's coming out of both sides. I keep hearing woman, and I keep hearing governor, and I keep thinking my governor, Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, who's, because they say, we. I've heard Harry Reid say, we want somebody who doesn't, who's not just a judge, who's not just been a judge. Well, you know, Governor Granholm, as you know,
right,
is a Harvard law graduate, state's attorney. She was attorney general, prosecutor, and then governor. So she has that experience. Squeaky clean. Full disclosure, I was on her executive team. Squeaky clean, great family.
Mm-hmm.
But she was for Hillary in the primary.
Yeah.
How does that affect the politics?
Well, I mean, I don't. He made Hillary Secretary of State, so I don't see that's an issue. I mean, if I had to guess who would be his nominee, would be Elena Kagan, who is the dean of Harvard Law School, because I think that she's got most of the qualities he's looking for, and I think he probably does want a woman, particularly because Ruth Bader Ginsburg is sick.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Jennifer Granholm, I think, is, a really viable choice. But, I think they'll make the decision fairly soon. But
is she a judge now?
She's dean of the Harvard Law School.
Oh, she's currently.
No, she's a solicitor general.
Okay, so she's never been a judge.
She just came to this administration, just in the few last.
Oh, as solicitor general. Okay.
Yeah.
So that'll be an interesting fight.
Right. I want to say one more thing about National Day of Prayer. I mean, we ask a question on faith this week of our panel. We have a very distinguished panel of theologians about should we have a day of prayer. And one of the most interesting and surprising ones was Cal Thomas, who is a conservative and an evangelical. And I mean, he basically wrote that Jesus instructed his disciples, but you, when you pray, enter into your closet, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father, which is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret shall reward you openly.
And
told them not to pray publicly, because he called those people hypocrites.
Right. I often
they do it for show, and whatever public reward they get will be their only reward. And, you know, I that's what bothers me about this whole National Day of Prayer. There's an awful lot of posturing going on. And we don't know how much serious, real, earnest, and legitimate prayer there is. It just seems to me a sideshow, you know. And I don't know why people who are believers and religious need to have a National Day of Prayer, because it would seem to me that every day would be a day of prayer. And for me, every day is a day of prayer, because for me, prayer is gratitude. That's what it means for me, but I don't need a national day for that.
Which are two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize that.
Yeah.
I feel the same way, Sally, when I talk about that stuff, too. So just, I know, last two points here. It often seems to me that those who pray the loudest, actually, have a lot.
Are the most suspect.
That hypocrisy factor is way up there.
Right.
And, you know, speaking of that, this is not because I don't disparage anyone who is religious. I'm Catholic. And people say, well, that you're not a Christian. Technically, we're not Christians because we're Catholic.
Yeah,
we kind of are. But the evangelical movement, obviously, it seems like they're being divided with Rick Warren and his development. He's, you know, now embracing the environment and many other things.
Mm-hmm.
But you still got Bristol Palin, darn it, we need out there. This is the hypocrisy factor you spoke of. You know, good Christian values.
I mean, the Bristol Palin thing, I think, is a real, really sad situation, too, the same way that Elizabeth Edwards is. I mean, here's this child who got pregnant, and as her mother pointed out, she chose to have the baby as her mother chose to have a Down syndrome child, which is really nice that they were able to have that choice because of the laws in this country. But I think that, you know, I think that...
Sally, I got my hard break coming up in 20 seconds, but we're going to have people go to your column at Washington Post. And this is a fabulous forum at WashingtonPost.com on faith forum, so I really would encourage people to go and weigh in. A lot of great topics on there. And thank you, Sally. It's so wonderful to have you on the show.
Okay, thanks so much for having me.
You
happy again.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
You bet. And I'm going to ask that question. We'll come back with a National Day of Prayer.
What is God?
National Day of Prayer. On the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. Oh, that's 1-888-O-NANCY. I actually like this tune, don't you? This is a good one, like for Madonna. So I thought I would wander here for a little bit on this topic. We just had Sally Quinn on from the Washington Post. She's got a forum on faith. It's really interesting, a lot of questions being asked about this. Now, okay, that's enough for this, Craig. It's good, but not that good. All right, so now President Obama is handling this differently than President Bush. Imagine that. It was mandated by Congress, May 7th, National Day of Prayer. The question was posed, what should President Obama do? Should he follow tradition and sign a ceremonial proclamation, or follow George W. Bush's practice of hosting a formal White House event, or should he ignore it completely? This is Cal Thomas posting this. He does raise a very good point, and I've often said this, too, whenever I've brought this up in my program. From my own 12 years of Catholic school, I remember this, certainly. Jesus instructed his disciples, but you, when you pray, enter into your closet, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father which is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret shall reward you openly. Matthew 6:6. He told them not to pray publicly like those he called hypocrites, because he said they do it for show, and whatever public reward they get will be their only reward. So he goes on to pose the question. I guess Obama baby basically split the baby here. He's signing a proclamation calling for a National Day of Prayer, and he's not holding any public events. He declined a public display of faith so prominent during Republican administrations. Oh, you know how this is going to be played, right? He didn't have the big National Day of Prayer. This is because he's a Muslim, not for God, something like that. I mean, my God, if Sean Hannity is going to give him a hard time because he ordered Dijon mustard on his hamburger. Do we have that, Craig? Let's play it. What are you doing? What, you're sitting there looking at me. You play it. Okay.
And finally tonight, as you all know, President Obama is a real man of the people. And yesterday he dropped by a popular Virginia restaurant to grab a burger with his pal Joe. Now, the Gateway Pundit blog pointed out that plain old ketchup, well, it didn't quite cut it for the president. Now, take a look at him ordering his burger with a very special condiment.
All right. I'm going to have your basic cheddar cheeseburger. Medium well. I just want mustard. No ketchup. If you got like a spicy mustard or something like that, or a Dijon mustard, something like that.
All right, Dijon mustard? I think the president watched just a little bit too much television as a kid.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
You mean the mustard?
Yes, would you have any?
Would I? Or do I?
Both, actually.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that fancy burger, Mr. President.
Okay, so if wanting a Dijon mustard on your burger warrants that kind of abuse from Sean Hannity, what will not having a public display of prayer, of just signing the proclamation and not having the big hoopla at the White House bring on? Oh, by the way, you're going to love this. I will be on Bill O'Reilly tomorrow night. Yes, I will be. All right, so that's the question. And he goes on to say, and before I set this up at 1-888-64-NANCY, I will get to your calls. Cal Thomas says, besides a broke and contrite spirit, God says he will not despise. I don't hear any calls for confession, repentance, or a broken and contrite spirit from this president or his Republican predecessors. The question that should be asked is, why would God bless a people who tolerate so many things God finds intolerable? Maybe we should all be praying about those things in our closets and on our knees. So, what are you praying for? Come on, honestly, what are you praying for? Or do you not pray? I mean, so, and this, I'm sure this will, Dan will kick off this conversation, but I'm going to tell you first, Dan, hold on one second. Sure. Because I'm going to share with people, I do. I grew up Catholic. I would say I'm a more spiritual person, but I do pray a lot, and I pray for guidance. You know, Lord, help me figure out what I need to be doing here, and wisdom. I do often say, what's the right thing to do? What do I need to do? You know, and as Sally Quinn said, I also give thanks for what I have. But pretty much that's it. I don't pray for a football team to win or this or that. I do pray that we all wisen up a little bit and that, you know, the things that I care about deeply, the global warming, those things, I do pray for the wisdom to do what I can do to help those things, and I think that's all you can do. But, yes, I pray. And if that is not cool, I know that it has become, to some on the left, anathema to say you pray or that you do. I know Ron Reagan on his show, I heard the promos, he's a proud atheist, and it's somehow become almost like a badge of honor that, you know, that you're more left if you are atheist. And I think that has put off a lot of us who consider ourselves progressives and also believe in a God and pray. And we've been shut out because we're not left enough because we're not atheists. So that pretty much handed it to you, Dan. I just teed up a softball from Long Beach calling in about Atheists United on this subject. Hi, Dan.
Hi there, Nancy.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to call in and let everyone know that what the Atheists United are doing in L.A. are we're actually setting up a National Day of Reason for Saturday, this coming Saturday the 9th. And what we're going to have everyone do is go and give blood, because for those of us that don't pray, we all understand that action has a lot more results than sitting with your hands folded.
Okay, well, I mean, it's good that you're doing, first of all, let me commend you that you're holding a blood drive. I think that's a fabulous thing. But do you think prayer just means sitting with your hands folded?
Yes.
Why?
Because it doesn't do anything.
Well, all right, first of all, I think you might be stereotyping here a bit, because when I've never had my hands folded
I
pray.
I may be on that, but at most, prayer would be meditation for oneself, but not in any way helps the world.
How do you know that, Dan? How could you possibly know that?
I don't know that, Nancy, but...
Because, see, I would posit, if you will, that any form of, see, I studied quantum physics for a long time. Oh, you're going to totally get the geek in me going.
Okay.
And any quantum physicist will tell you this, that everything is energy. There is nothing solid. There's no mass here. You know, I got my Sharpie pen, whatever. Here's my BlackBerry Storm. If you put this under a powerful microscope and look at it further and further, everything goes molecules and particles. You know, but there's no mass. There is no such thing as mass. It's all energy. It just vibrates at different rates. So the more solid an object it is, a heavier chair, whatever, the lower the vibration. So thoughts are the same thing. Thoughts are just energy, and so they're just vibrating. Thoughts vibrate at the highest frequencies, but it's still the same thing. It is exactly the same thing. And so when you pray, you are emitting, you are literally emitting energy. You are putting power to what it is you're putting your attention on. And so if you think of it as in prayer, like, oh, God, please help me, and you're asking for something, and I think that's your conception of it as
Not exactly. I understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
But what essentially that you're saying is that, you know, when you pray, you're putting more energy into the world and specifically on what it is that you're praying for, right? Or whatever it is that you're focusing your attention on during that prayer.
Because whatever you focus your attention on, you are sending energy to. Literally sending energy to. So when I talk to folks who object to me not wanting to spend all my energy, all our collective energy focused on going back and prosecuting and torture, there are real reasons for that beyond just, I think we have better things to do and I don't like that or blah, 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 all those emails I get. The real practical reason is I think that the more we are all, each of us individually, then collectively, consciously focusing on this terrible negative thing, then we are giving more energy to those dark things that we don't want to, when we could be putting our energy toward problems that we can solve and doing good, you know, volunteering. This is like another example. When you volunteer, you're doing your blood drive. I will guarantee you this, that you think you're doing something for someone else by doing that, but just the act of giving will give you a more beneficial, you will walk out of there a happier person. Your mood will have been elevated. Whenever you do anything, I was a hospice volunteer, and I got far more out of it than anything else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's because you gave. You gave energy to something. You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I understand what you're saying, but where you're coming from actually sounds a lot like that that book, The Secret, that quite a few people swear to around Southern California. I don't know many other places.
Well, I mean, all over. I mean, it's one of many books that kind of, I think it's a simplified version of, I've studied quantum physics for a long time to believe it, and, you know, to sort of understand it. But that's not the physical aspect of it. That's sort of a simplification of it.
Okay.
And what would, do you dispute that?
I'm sorry?
Do you dispute that, the quantum physics aspect of what I'm saying?
Yeah, actually I do. I was going to ask you then, so if I, you know, if I'm praying and I'm praying for my stapler then has more energy, but not in any way that is scientifically measurable.
Well, what we do know is this, scientifically.
Okay.
We know that the one thing that we found out through quantum research is that it's called the Heisenberg principle.
Okay.
And what it says is that, and this is, they've done real, there's a great book called The Force, and it's called Secrets of the Universe. And it's she was a British journalist who interviewed all the quantum physicists in the modern century. And all their studies, these are double-blind studies, you know, scientific studies.
Of course.
And one of them was a Heisenberg principle where they actually had people, scientists, they would try and figure out whether a particle was, it could be a wave or it could be a particle, okay? And depending on the perception of the observer, that result of those, that experiment would change depending on the result of what they expected to see. So, in fact, they called it the Heisenberg principle. And the takeaway from that is that your observations, your expectations of what you think will be are actually changing what will be.
Reality is perception.
Correct. But there is something, that what is your takeaway of then? What your expectations are actually changes the physical matter of what is created. Do you see how profound that is?
I absolutely do, but I don't see how that relates to prayer in the broader sense, because if, you know, say it does change something from particle matter to wave, I don't understand how you...
Well, there are implications beyond a stapler. Okay, there's implications beyond a stapler here, okay?
Okay.
How does that work? If you focus hatred,
mm-hmm.
then you will create more hatred in this world. That's just a simple truth. If you focus it, you refine it, and if everybody focuses that emotion, you're essentially creating that. And if you choose,
I agree with that, but I don't think that that's for any reason of us actually changing reality. If you are filled with hatred, you're going to be a hateful person. You're not going to be a good person to be around.
You're going to be mean to people, and then those people are going to be mad, and they'll be filled with hatred.
Absolutely.
And you have created more and more of that.
Of course, and I understand, you know, that. But as far as prayer goes, when you do pray, it's not meditation. There's a difference between prayer and meditation. And meditation,
why?
I can actually understand.
Aren't those just words?
Because you don't meditate to a god.
Well, who do you know? I mean, what's the difference? You're talking about...
Okay, when you pray, what do you pray to?
I don't talk, you know, you're talking about form, like formality of it. I don't get down my knees and cross my hands and blah, blah, blah. Who do I pray to? You know, I say, Lord, help me. Lord, give me some guidance here. Lord, you know, I say, Lord, and that is I grew up it doesn't matter what tradition you are. I grew up as a Catholic and a Christian. It doesn't matter, though. I've studied all the religions. Just the act of connection is what's really important.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's what bothers me about the atheism, the whole thing about it. And I respect everyone. It's your right to have your beliefs. But
or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. Right, exactly. But you know what? It's not it's not right or wrong for people who do believe in this either. And I think the left has gotten a little harsh on that, too.
Well, I think we've only gotten harsh on that simply because when it extends from someone's personal prayer to the broader sense, like the last administration did, and like the evangelicals try to do very much by putting it in the public eye and forcing it upon others, that is where we get a little more militant about it.
Yeah, well, then, that was my first point. They were hypocrites. They're using prayer and using the...
using religion entirely.
Exactly. That's not authentic, and that's not what I'm talking about. And on that point, Dan, we would be in complete agreement. All right, Dan. Good. Give a plug for your blood drive, though, for people that want to go do something good. Because that'd be a good thing for people to do right now. It'd make you feel better and help everyone else out.
All right. Thank you, Nancy.
Wait. Where is it?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's We are all meeting at the Children's Hospital in L.A.
Okay.
Anywhere you are in the world, just go give blood on Saturday. That's it.
On Saturday, but you are all going to be at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles.
Yes.
That's what it's called, the L.A. Children's Hospital?
Yes.
Okay, to do that. So that you'll get more people go to do that. So that's a good thing you are doing, Dan.
All right,
and I'm glad you took the time to call. All right.
Thanks.
Great. 1-888-64-NANCY. I don't think anyone understood me there. But what I was trying to get at. But it is. It kind of bothered me. I filled in at Air America one time, and Ron Reagan was doing all his promos, and it was like, proud atheist, I'm proud. And I felt like, you know what? What is believing in God such a bad thing? Does that make me a Republican because I believe in God? Because it's like all of a sudden the left has sort of taken that on. I'm sorry. I think that we don't use it like they did. But the fact that it's real, you know, shouldn't be pushed aside either, and that people believe in God. So I guess I'm ambivalent on the National Day of Prayer. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. Go again, confounding labels, troublemaker. It is a Nancy Skinner show. I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64 Nancy. No, I mean, it's National Day of Prayer, and it got in the conversation. I do. I feel like I filled in at Ron, I said Air America, if you're just joining me, and it was all proud atheist, and it just almost is like if you do believe in God, as I do, and I pray all the time, you're somehow not a you know, bona fide lefty. I think we've let the right co-opt that whole thing. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God, right? I mean, come on, people. It seems like that was not a good move. Let's go to the phones. Colleen's in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Nancy. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. A little nervous. Never called before, but...
It's just me. Don't even worry about it.
All right. No, I just, you know, when you said, like, about, you know, the Republican, it does seem like the Republicans try to own God, and that if you're a Democrat, you, you know, shouldn't be a God-loving person. I don't know how that got to that. I don't know how they think that they own him, and we are just not with them. And I just wanted to tell you that you're not crazy, because I believe the same thing, unless we're both crazy.
No,
it's a possibility, but I don't know you.
That may be, but I like you already, Colleen. Thank you. No, you're not crazy. You're correct. They knew the power of God and the flag, and they used it more appropriately than we did. I say it's time to take them both back as we continue on the Nancy Skinner Show. show as we continue to talk shrubball. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. Before we move along here, I got a phone call and an email on this last subject. So this kind of makes my point. Jane writes in, "Hi, Nancy. Okay, so you believe in the power of prayer. Good for you. So do I. However, I don't put down my other friends who don't. You are obviously so insecure in your beliefs that you feel you have to put down others who openly do not believe. Ron Reagan, who I love, how his show is great. You could learn a thing or two by listening. I'm so over, in capital letters, people in this country shoving their religion or spiritual beliefs down our throats. I'm so glad President Obama didn't do too much for this day of prayer. This is an individual choice, remember, separation of church and state. You were meaner about Ron Reagan being an atheist than Hannity picking on the President Obama over spicy mustard. You might want to think about why you were..." I'm going to go on. She's just going on and on. All I said was this, Jane. There's nothing wrong with believing in God, okay? And when those of us who actually do believe in God are made to feel as if we are not somehow as rigidly, and that's all. I love Ron Reagan's show. I listen to it when I go in the car on the way home. He has a different style. Again, none of us, we're not competing with each other. We're all different flavors of ice cream. I don't know how many times I have to say that. I just said when people who do believe in God are somehow made to believe that we're less progressive or Democrat or something, or that we shouldn't bring that up or stomp that out, I don't agree with that. I wasn't being mean. He says his promos on his show say, "I am proudly atheist," blah, 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 as if somehow if you are not atheist, you aren't doing the right thing. And that sort of bothers me. And that's what I'm saying. It bothers me. It makes me feel uncomfortable. And I'm not being mean to him personally at all. 1-888.
Hi, Nancy. Well, I'm not a big defender of prayer or religion, but I do have a response to that gentleman who is saying that he feels prayer is useless. I think that prayer sometimes involves thinking and analysis. And I don't think that you can separate action, which he's taking with his blood drive. You can't really separate. And in order for your body to function, you have to use your mind. So I don't, for him mm-hmm. to say that everything is action.
But come on. I mean, look at this brings back the Elizabeth Edwards thing. She has terminal illness. I mean, we all have to face our mortality. And, it seems as if, you've got to think about your soul. You have to think about the purpose of your life. You have to think about not only when you say analysis, and I agree with you, Nancy, and action, but like purpose, greater purpose in life, meaning in life, priorities. I mean, I think when you start to think about your mortality and you're on this earth for a very short time, that changes your day-to-day activities. That's going to change the actions and your analysis, everything you do, because ultimately you're like, why am I here? I'm only here for a short time. What do I want out of life?
That's right. Yeah, I agree. You really have to think and analyze before you can act.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there you go. Thank you so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll just mosey on along here is this Car? Is that Car? Hi, Car.
Hi. Can you hear me okay? I got you on speakerphone.
Or Carrie. Hi. I hear you just fine.
I totally agree with you. I get sick of being feeling like, okay, in order to be left minded, I have to be, you know, atheistic, and I'm starting to feel that myself, and I don't like that.
Yeah,
I've been one that always did complain that if you weren't right wing and then their version of God, that you weren't the right person or you weren't voting the right way. Got pressure from that from used to be TV evangelism, and I got to the point where I stopped watching it.
Well, and I think that the Republicans successfully co-opted that. I think that was a strategy of President Bush and Karl Rove to go after the Christian evangelical right and make that a centerpiece. And again, even we saw this, I just saw on that On Faith forum at WashingtonPost.com, said the majority of Catholics aren't even listening to the bishops. The bishops who said that Obama shouldn't go to Notre Dame because of he's pro-choice. 50% of Catholics didn't agree with that. 48% hadn't even really heard about that controversy, and they're not listening to them anyways. So I just think that they've co-opted religion in a way that we need to bring back. If you believe, I am not saying there's anything wrong if you don't believe in God. I'm not saying that you know, that's a bad position. But I don't think you should make us feel, the people who do believe in God, that we aren't, you know, we aren't progressive left enough. There's a conformity pressure that is going on there.
Look, this is how progressive I consider myself. I actually dated a Republican trying to keep an open mind. We both wanted Hillary to win at the time. But I said, whoever my party nominates, and I'm an African-American, I was going to go for that. I wound up with the most godless Republican. I said, of all the Republicans in the world, I get one that doesn't even believe in God. And once Obama started running, he got so negative, and it impacted our whole relationship and stopped everything. And he always was telling me, oh, you think God is real? Prove it, prove it. I'm like, brother, I'm an African-American. We started the civil rights thing with God and prayer and marching. And, come on.
And you're behind the man, and he's behind the woman, and he's a Republican, and you're a Democrat. Well, that's not going to work out so well. Well, thanks, Carr. Appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
Okay. 1-888-64-NANCY. I suppose we're on this. They've picked this fight. I'll take it. I'll pick it up because it has bothered me. And I do think that it's okay to speak of value. We should be. In fact, I'll take it further than that. I think, you know, just whatever. I think you should quote a lot of great spiritual leaders. I'm not confined to one religion. But if we started doing that more, then I think you'd be drawing a lot of people who do believe in God to start listening to you because they agree with you on some level. Let's go to Kristen. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
First time caller, but I so agree with what you said earlier. This is my problem with the whole prayer thing. I don't have a problem with prayer. I have a problem, like, I listen to Ron Reagan Show also. I have a problem that he proclaims his atheism. I don't have a problem with the fact that he believes in it. I have a problem that he proclaims it. Same thing with homosexuality. I don't have a problem with gays coming straight out saying I'm gay. I have, you know, I'm in school right now, and I've had classmates who, on the first day of class, in just talking, answering a question, will just come out and say they're gay. Who cares? Why do they get, my question is, why do they get all the rights, and we who are believers, our rights are taken away? Atheists and people who don't believe in God, I'm a school teacher, and when kids don't want to stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance because God is in it, they have their right. Why can't I have my right to proclaim my belief? Just like they have their right to, you know, proclaim their disbelief.
Well, we all have free speech. I mean, you have the right to say, you know, whatever you want.
I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with the fact that because I don't believe what they believe, my free speech is taken away.
But it isn't, really. I don't think, Chris, who's taking your free speech away in this debate?
And when people complain that because we're believers in God, we can't, you know, we can't talk about it in school. We can't, you know, people get offended if we say we're believers and we believe in God. That's my point. That they get to share their disbelief, but we don't get to share our belief without being...
Yeah. I think you're talking more about the church and state issue and the Pledge of Allegiance.
I'm not necessarily talking about in church or in schools. I'm talking about in general. People that I talk to on the street, they don't want to hear about it. And they'll, you know, unapologetically say, I don't really want to hear that. And they don't mind telling you they don't want to hear about your God, but they don't mind sharing you about their disbelief in God. That's my point, whether it's in the church or in school or not.
Should be a personal thing, huh? Is that your point? It's a personal choice. It is.
Yeah, it is. And everybody should be free to say how they feel, whether if I want to pray. And I don't understand what people have against prayer. Prayer, if we were praying for something that was bad and tragic, I could understand that. But prayer brings about good results. We're praying for positive things to happen, positive change.
Right.
So I don't know.
If Dan, my atheist caller, was right, if he's right and prayer is at worst it's benign, okay? At worst it's benign. At best, if I'm right, it's powerful. Let's go to Joe in Long Beach. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going? Basically, in response to the lady that just called you, I don't mind having religion taught in school as long as we're teaching all religions, not just, you know, one form of religion. Secondly, I just had a conversation with some guy at the gym, and me being raised Catholic and going to Catholic school for 12 years, I consider myself a reasonable person, and at least right now in my life, I can say, you know, I don't know if there is a God. Where people that do believe in God and proclaim that there is a God are 100% sure that there is a God. They cannot say, well, I don't know there is a God, or you may
which
be right.
Which would be
they're
agnostic,
sure.
Right?
And,
which...
and it's a belief. It's faith. That's what
sure.
you call it, is faith.
Sure. I mean, because there's, well, the question is, unless you could prove it, it is a belief. And the idea that you can prove God, I think every major philosopher in the world has tried to take that on.
Well, but even being told that, you know, there's proof. There's actual proof that with regards to all the scripture and all that's been, you know, stated in the Bible, that all of that is true. And, you know, for me, you know, how do we know?
Well, I'll tell you, let me answer.
Okay.
I don't think that's proof. No, no, no. I mean, you are correct in terms of what we know scientifically to be provable. But mm-hmm. let me tell you why my belief is as strong as it is. And okay. I mentioned this before. I was a hospice volunteer for a number of years in Chicago. And that was just because of my personal circumstance. My sister-in-law passed away when she was young, and we had that experience, so I became one. And I'll tell you, anyone who's in that business, is, you know, you're kind of there with when they are, you know, crossing that line, that life and death line. And those people are sure. They have seen so many instances where somebody's talking to somebody. There is something going on. There is a change, like the person's floating upside down or something, or they're saying mother, or there's things, strange thing. So to me, that was, for me, you know, I believe because I was brought up to believe and went through 12 years myself of Catholic school, but that strengthened my belief. When you actually see that, and I see miracles in life every day. I see strange
right.
things that I say, there's no way, the odds against this happening, you know, are impossible.
Right.
This is a miracle. So that's why my belief is strong, Joe.
Right.
No, is it provable? It's not.
And you know, and I can respect that. And I give people with strong beliefs a lot of, you know, credit. I was at the foot of my mom's bed when she died of cancer 15 years ago. And for some reason, the first thought that came to my mind when she actually died was her spirit left her body. But see, I was conditioned to think that way. You know, it could just be energy leaving her body. And I kind of viewed her body as just a capsule. Now, am I waiting for a sign? Yeah, I'm still waiting. But to actually, you know, believe that, you know, I'm
okay, then here's what
again.
You hang your hat
know.
On. Here's what, as we leave, here's what you have hang your hat on, Joe. What is a more comforting belief? That her spirit did leave her body and she went to heaven, a better place? Or that nothing happened? What is a more comforting belief for you, Joe, to carry in the absence of provable, discernible evidence? Which one's more comfortable
well,
to you?
And what's comfortable is, yes, that my mom,
but she's in a good place,
and that I'm going to see her,
and you're going to see her again.
But
in the absence of certainty, which Ron Reagan doesn't have either, he can't prove there's not a God. Okay, I can't prove there is one. And in the absence of uncertainty, I choose the comfort of my beliefs that there is a better place. And I think you should too, Joe. That your mom is in a better place, and you will see her.
Well, I would hope that there is a better place, but again. Regarding people that have to wear their religion on their sleeves, which I believe the caller that preceded me is like, and I hate to, you know, assume, but I don't like people pushing their religion in my face. I don't. Religion is personal.
I gotta go,
okay.
Joe. I'm sorry. I'm just plumb out of time, and that's not what I was trying to do. It's National Day of Prayer. I was just getting people's thoughts on it. I'm a talk show host. 1-888-64 Nancy. bankers are praying. The bankers are engaged in amen, hallelujah. Stress test results being released here. Federal regulators are saying that these bankers must raise $75 billion. What's $75 billion in extra capital by November? A more upbeat verdict on the health of the financial system than the industry had feared just 2 months ago. Okay, Citigroup needs $5.5 billion. Bank of America needs $34 billion. Maybe they could put a little, you know, donation jar out at the grocery stores for Bank of America. Maybe they should get down on their knees and pray. So what I haven't seen yet is the criterion, the methodology, and if an auto collapse was factored into those stress tests, folks. That would be divine intervention. All right, coming up, Afghanistan and Pakistan, the ultimate nations in need of our prayer on the Nancy Skinner Show. We could pray for world peace all we want, but we got to do something about it. President Obama, yes, on Wednesday, actually, met with President Zardari of Pakistan and Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan. We haven't gotten a chance to talk about that on the Nancy Skinner Show, so we're going to take this opportunity now to dive into this. You want to talk about nightmare scenario going on over there. Let's do that. Let's see what happened on Wednesday, what the challenges are. Already there are splits among the president and Congress about the what we're calling, I guess, the AFPAC policy now. Joining me to talk about is Marco. It's Vincenzino? Is that
correct?
Vincenzino. I love that. He's the founder and director of the Global Strategy Project. Thanks, Marco, for joining me.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us what happened. The meeting looked very uncomfortable. Nobody looked happy. what happened behind the scenes? Was there any progress? Did we come out with, here's what we came up with, here's our go-forward to-do plan?
Sure. No, I think for the most part, it was an initial meeting between three leaders who were the first time met simultaneously. I mean, President Bush had these type of meetings before, had several of them with Karzai and President Musharraf. And the chemistry between Musharraf and Karzai was really bad. But this time around, Karzai and Musharraf have known each other for several years, so they're actually friends. So I think in that sense, in order to begin some substantive dialogue, you have to have at least some good personal chemistry between the people involved. So I think in that sense, you would say behind the scenes, what was probably emphasized was
the hard
security.
Did you mean to say that Zardari and Karzai have some good relationships? Or?
Yeah, he was Karzai's friendship with President Zardari.
Okay, because you said Musharraf.
Yeah, let me clarify. Yeah, it was with President Zardari and his wife, Benazir Bhutto. Karzai knew both of them very well. Mm-hmm. I had a personal friendship with them that goes back time. So I think that's, and then plus they've had several visits between each other over the past year, between Karzai and Zardari. But I think with the most part, what wasn't officially discussed in public, it was a lot of the security situation. I would say behind the scenes, with the president of Pakistan, I think the President Obama was coming down pretty hard on him regarding the security situation on the ground, basically telling them no more accords with the Taliban, no more agreements with them, no more accommodation. You have to be serious about attacking them, particularly if you look at the last couple of weeks. I mean, many of them were advancing. The Taliban were advancing on urban centers in Pakistan. They're about 100 kilometers away. It's about 80 miles away from Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan.
Yeah, 60 miles away from where we believe nuclear weapons are stored.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, that's debatable where the actual nuclear weapons are stored. The government claims that they're far from, they're not near the capital. They're in safe places, and the U.S. government has said, you know, has more or less agreed with it. But I would say in reality, even if they're in some other part of the country, the fact that they're so close to the actual troops, the radicals, they're so close to the nation's
that's
capital.
That's even scarier to me. If you could talk about Waziristan and some of these tribal regions, if that's where they are, they're actually more vulnerable, I think, than if they were in the nation's capital. It can be kind of like fortified in like a green zone, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, even if they're far from the capital, they're in the far east of Pakistan, the fact that these radicals are getting so close to the nation's capital, the center of control, of political control, is, of course, a major concern. So I think that's dominated discussions behind the scenes with President Zardari. Well, with President Karzai, initially you saw in the early weeks of the Obama administration, there's a lot of, you know, highly charged rhetoric against President Karzai, and for legitimate reasons, I mean, regarding corruption, a lot that was going on the ground, the government need to show more force, more assertiveness. And I think overall the relationship between President Obama and Karzai has improved. And also the fact on August 20th you have the elections in Afghanistan, and President Karzai, his opposition, I would say, has a very, probably no chance of winning. So President Obama made the pragmatic decision that it's best to have a good relationship with this person. He may not be crazy about him, but at least you're going to have to work with him for the next few years.
What's the state of, just let's take Afghanistan and then Pakistan. What is the state of electoral politics there? Karzai, unlike, obviously we know there was an election in Pakistan, Musharraf was the general who took over in a coup, and then there was an election, although it was really wacky. Zardari is power sharing with the former Pervez, who is the former prime minister he's power sharing with? Zardari.
The guy
who was displaced by Musharraf.
He took the power from Musharraf,
right.
And then there was talk of him with Sharif sharing power, but that never happened. So Zardari went on his own.
Oh, okay. But democratically elected. Is there democratic elections? Is Karzai's operation, his electoral processes clean or suspect?
The basic word that you can use to refer to the system of politics is tribal. And what I mean by tribal is that, yes, there is one person, one vote, but many of the votes go according to what tribal elders, particularly in the rural parts of the country, where the tribal elders decide agreements that are cut between tribal elders and the central government, and then they'll get their votes. They'll tell their tribes more or less to vote for them. Mm-hmm.
We kind of have that here in the United States, too, you know. A lot of people take their marching orders from whichever tribe they subscribe to. Okay, so Karzai, there's tremendous corruption going on. The big problem there is that with him, he and the Taliban, it's essentially the same problem, that they're kind of working it both ways, that the Taliban props up, let's help me understand it, the Taliban helps prop up the warlords help prop up these leaders in some political fashion, right? So they have the United States with a heavy hand on them, trying to get them to crack down on the Taliban, and they understand the risks of an overthrow if the Taliban really gained power, but they don't have an inherent political interest in a full-out crackdown of these warlords and Taliban and Al-Qaeda warlords.
I mean, if you look at the tribal level in Afghanistan, much of it depends on who can give most in terms of leverage, resources, money, preference in terms of government policies. So I want to say that these warlords are up for grab, but in many parts of the country, you can sort of say that. What I mean is that if the government goes in and promises them government jobs, gives them, you know, the security and does infrastructure development, things of that nature, then you can win over people on the local levels. The difficulty you're running into is that many of these local levels, security is not there to do the infrastructure development. So it's hard to, even if you cut these deals, the central government cuts these deals with these local warlords or these local tribal, maybe call them tribal leaders, might be some somewhat of a more accurate term. Even if you cut deals with them, and you the ability to deliver those goods is very difficult because in these rural areas, the Taliban, they still have a lot of great, you know, heavy presence on the ground. The point I'm making is that only...
Is that why President Obama wants 20,000 more troops on the ground?
Yeah.
Because you have to be able to deliver. He has a $7.5 billion five-year plan in Pakistan, for instance, and hey, wow, what a concept. If we actually improve the lives of Pakistanis, investing in schools and hospitals and water projects, maybe they won't want to kill us, and maybe they won't try and get that nuclear arsenal. But you're saying that the troops on the ground help pave the way for that that money. You can't just drop airlift money. We tried that, actually, paying them off with just money, and it was just rampant corruption, right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the point is that if you look at it in terms of short-term and long-term, in the past few years, we haven't dedicated the resources, both, I mean, particularly military, to hold the ground to make the development happen. And if you don't have that, if you don't have the military, the civilian reconstruction can't take place. So now with the president increasing the troops, the idea is to hold that ground, deliver the services, conduct the infrastructure development, build the schools, the hospitals, so people at the local level can see progress taking place. It gives hope for the future. It gives provides credibility for the international mission and for the Afghan government, which is very, very important, because if they don't have, they look at their government as corrupt and not representative of them, obviously it's easy for them to turn against the government. And I think go with the Taliban, but, you know, by default, go into their hands or go into their sway or influence.
Then let's move over to Pakistan here briefly, because there's a little different dynamic there. And my guest is Marco Vijayan. I'm terrible at names, Marco. Please don't hold this against me. Vijayan Sinha. Pakistan has, it seems to me that they're more worried about India and Kashmir than they are the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And is that our issue, is like trying to stop this long-running ancient fight they have with India long enough to focus on the rebels in their midst?
The point that you're making, I think, was you can specifically apply that to the Pakistani military. Maybe not to the elements of the population. Yeah, I mean, they've always been concerned about India, but it's specifically the Pakistani military operates with that psyche, is that it's like with us during the Cold War, everything focused on Russia, you know, the evil empire, they were out to get us, we were in constant struggle with them. And for much of the Pakistani military, there is that mindset, and they see the people on their western border, these radicals, they say, well, ultimately, they're Pakistani, they're not much of a threat for us. If we're in a war with India, they would side with us. But now they're starting to realize that these radicals have a much larger agenda. It's not just to have, just to stay in that
province. Kashmir, right.
Yeah.
It's not, but you know, what's interesting to me, or concerning to me, I should say, is that the former, Musharraf's former general, Pervez Kayani, that big fat guy, he is still the general. So, now with Zardari. So you've got Musharraf's guy in charge of the military. No matter what, the military in Pakistan is so much, it's almost a power struggle, is it not, with the president? So
yeah, I mean, last year in Washington, I was at a conference that was the Gilani, who's the prime minister of Pakistan, spoke, and it was last July. He said publicly, we control the intelligence services and we control the military. I mean, I could not think of anything more ridiculous. The military, although it's sort of acknowledged it doesn't want to get involved in the political process, if this current government continues being weak at some stage, they might have to interfere again. And plus, I mean, the government does not control the military and the intelligence services. And within the military and intelligence services, you have a lot of factionalism, a lot of rogue elements within them that are in cahoots together with these with the Taliban on the northwest frontier provinces, who supported them, who created them, and continue relationships.
You're talking about the ISI propping up the
theory
that the ISI, the intelligence agencies, are in fact cooperating with them on one hand, and then reporting that they're fighting them up to the ranks, to the political ranks on the other
it's
hand?
That's an extremely ambiguous situation. How many are exactly, who's participating or collaborating with them, that could be subject to the debate. The fact that it's taking place, I don't think it's subject to debate, but how much of it, to the extent of it, that is subject to debate. But I would say at this stage, obviously these individuals, for them, for the Taliban to go to the extent that they have approaching on the urban centers of Pakistan, they could not have done this all alone. Over the years, they were prepared, they were given weapons, I think this would prove, the extent of their advances has proven that there is participation and collaboration at some of the highest levels of the Pakistani military and intelligence services.
Hmm. So the key is to get Karzai and Zardari working in, cooperatively against these enemies. You might be able to overcome some of these really large obstacles.
Yeah. Without coordination and collaboration, it's going to be an impossible situation.
Because it's already a mess to begin with. Well, thank you so much. Marco Vigencino is the founder and director of the Global Strategy Project. You got a website, Marco?
Yes, globalstrategyproject.org.
So if you want to, really delve into this and get to know all the craziness that is in this region, I'm quite sure you'll learn a lot by visiting that website. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right, one more quick segment to go. What is it with me and names? I don't know. He's got it phonetically spelled right. Vigencino. I don't know. See, I'm not perfect. I never said I was. For all my hate me fans, I can't claim perfection. Just put it out there. Talk show host. Right. She's just a talk show host. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number. Our last segment on this penultimate sort of crazy day. I must say, I haven't had a lot of time to focus on foreign policy on the most recent incarnation of the Nancy Skinner Show because foreign policy has not been front and center in the crisis mode as it had been in years past. It has been a global economic meltdown. But I will say this. I'm glad we took some time to talk about this because it's important. And a lot of people, what I'm hearing around the discussion with Afghanistan and Pakistan is that, they're lumping it into the Iraq bucket. And they're criticizing President Obama sending troops in, like, we've done that. This doesn't work. David Obey, he's the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, has said he will give the White House 1 year to show results. As if it's just like Iraq. And now this is Obama's Iraq. It really bothers me when I hear that. Because President Obama, when I was running against him, yes, said routinely, time after time, in debates, that he called Iraq a stupid war, actually. Use those words. It's on my website. Go check it out, some of the Senate debates. But he said that it was a distraction on the real problem, which is Pakistan and Afghanistan. And that is where the Taliban, who launched their attacks from 9/11, were based. And he has always maintained that throughout his campaign, that he would focus his efforts, that he would draw down troops from Iraq, but that we must confront the situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I mean, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and they the rebels in that area, as my last guest just said, got within 60 miles of Islamabad. Okay, well, we don't know where the nukes are, but let's just say it's not a good thing that you have nuclear weapons that are within this very unstable environment, where you have, as we pointed out. There is a split in who's running the show over in Pakistan. You got Zardari, the president, elected after Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. There were elections. But you have Musharraf. He got ousted, but his guy, this guy, Kayani, I don't mean to be rude when I call him a big fat guy, but he does weigh like 400 pounds. And he still runs the military. So President Bush was praising a dictator, Musharraf, all these years, who was appeasing the Taliban at the same time, and Al-Qaeda. I mean, they're different terrorists, but they're all in that same region, and empowering them. And the fact is, this world has became less safe as a result of all that distraction on the war in Iraq. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. So it's twofold. Think of it that way. They'd never had those weapons of mass destruction to begin with, and we had good material reports on that. Meanwhile, they weren't paying attention to what was going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that situation could be potentially out of control. And so to put a one-year time limit on him, as if that's like going back and saying, as if Obama would have had his way from the beginning, we would have never been in Iraq and we could have been focusing all this time. You don't cut him short and say, Congressman, you cannot, as Congressman, limit the President of the United States and his foreign policy on your timetable because of the failures in Iraq. I guess I'm out of time. If you want to comment on this, write me at Nancy at nancyskinnerlive.com. Or we'll talk about it tomorrow on the Nancy Skinner Show. Oh, O'Reilly tomorrow. Sorry, guys.